Well, again, this is going to be review for some. I think we'll get into some of the stuff on the the article, the NEC article 240.87. That, you know, that rule that keeps changing. The 2014 code changed it again. It's the one that says you can't use. You can't have an LS breaker. Back in the old days, we used to have, long time, short time, instantaneous LSI or LSIG. And you would put an LS breaker at your main because you didn't want it to trip instantaneously. For selector coordination, you wanted the breakers downstream to trip first. Well, now the code prohibits you doing that. So it's like, okay, what am I supposed to do? So we'll talk about that. But just kind of as a level set. I mean, selector coordination just basically says the breaker close to the fault trips, and the breaker upstream of it does not trip for all currents, all times. So 1 amp or a million amps. The breaker closest to the fault always clears first. Series rating is a technology that you typically see when you have, say, a 10,000 amp breaker downstream of a 30,000 amp source. Well, you could put 30,000 amp breakers in there, but a lower cost solution is to put in a current limiting main, and then you put in the 10,000 amp feeder. Well, the theory behind that is, how many times are you really going to get a bolted fault, right? When are you going to get 30,000 amps? It's when somebody literally bolts the wires together, tightens them together. You do not get 30,000 amps when you drop a crescent wrench across the wires. That's an arcing fault. And arcs have impedance. No, a bolted fault is where you've literally bolted the wires together. So the theory is, for series rating, is the 80-20 rule, or the 99-1 rule. For 99% of the time, the system's fine having a current limiting main and a 10,000 amp breaker. But if you do get that crazy fault, instead of the thing blowing up in your face, the main's going to trip out and you lose selective coordination. But is a series rated system selectively coordinated? No, not by the code definition. So that's the issue. That's the issue. So you can't put this in emergency circuits. But the rest of the time, it's basically the expertise of the PE. You would analyze it. You would go to the client and say, here's what it's going to cost to upgrade to 65 kA breakers all the way through the system versus a series rating kind of a solution. And this works, and when I say current limiting main, it could be a fuse, right? Because you can put a current limiting fuse upstream of a breaker and get higher ratings downstream. And then a TCC. Well, speaking of TCCs, we're familiar with TCCs, but there's a whole lot of other protective devices. If you get involved in generators, I see this more, but also solar, anything that could possibly backfeed, anything that could possibly generate power, it's not just the 50-51 relays anymore. It's not the current relays anymore. You'll see numbers like this. You'll see 59 and 27. 59 is IEEE overvoltage, 27 under phase loss, phase imbalance. The technical term for 46 is negative sequence over current. Technical name for 47 is negative sequence over voltage. But I mentioned this in passing yesterday, symmetrical components, which is positive sequence, negative sequence, zero sequence, you will not ever have negative sequence unless you have unbalanced voltages and or currents. So it's a mathematical construct. But we know it as phase loss, phase imbalance. The IEEE numbering, you'll be looking through the list, and where's the phase loss, phase imbalance? Oh, negative sequence over current, negative sequence over voltage. Directional current power. Directional current is an IEEE 67 device. Directional power is a 32 device. Power can be either watts or VARs. So you'll also see directional power used on loss of field, which is an IEEE 40 device. Loss of field is, remember we talked about yesterday, synchronous machines? You buy the big Caterpillar engine and you have a synchronous generator? Well, there's a DC power supply that's basically powering up a DC electromagnet to create a voltage that's precisely synchronous to the rotational speed. That's what synchronous means. An induction machine has slip. So when that rotor is rotating around inside that motor housing, it's rotating at slightly different than synchronous speed. So if you look at the nameplate on an induction machine, it'll say 1750 RPM. It doesn't say 1800 RPM. Well, that's because it's slipping. It's going a little bit slower. Because in an induction machine, the way it induces current in the rotor bars is it has to break lines of flux. If it's exactly tracking the rotational field, no lines of flux are being broken, no current is induced in the rotor, and there's no torque. So that's why if you look at the speed torque curve of an induction machine, as you get closer to full speed, you start losing all your torque. But that's not the case with synchronous machines. Synchronous machines can produce whatever torque you want at synchronous speed. But to do that, you have to have a separate power supply. It's basically a permanent magnet rotating inside of that magnetic field. So the permanent magnet precisely tracks the rotating magnetic field. All that's to say is, what would happen if you lost that field? Well, now you've lost connection to the, you know, there's no more connection between those two, and the shaft is spinning free, and all kinds of bad stuff could happen. The generator's connected to it. Remember, there's this big engine, and it's trying to torque that thing. Well, all of a sudden there's no load. It just, the shaft could fly off its bearings. So you always have a loss of field relay, but you can also use a 32. Over under frequency is the 81 relay. You'll use that a lot of times at your service entrance when you have loss of utility. So think about this. You've got a system that has solar energy or power. You've got some sort of a cogeneration system, and they're perfectly synchronized. Well, I don't know if you realize this, but the controller that's inside that system does not control the frequency. It controls the power. So in other words, think about this. Take the biggest generator you could think of that you would hook up to a hospital, 2-3 megawatts. It doesn't matter how much gas I push onto that thing, it's not going to change the grid frequency one iota. You know, that big 2-gigawatt plant down the street is the one that's setting the frequency. But what happens if I cut that connection? Well, there's no closed loop on that generator that's trying to maintain frequency. It's pedal to the metal, boys. It's pushing power. Well, I've lost connection to the grid. What's it going to do? Over frequency. So typically the 81 relay is the one that's going to trip off. It's going to tell you that you've lost utility. There's one time when this doesn't work, and that's when the power consumed by the facility is precisely produced by the on-site generation, in which case there's no power that's flowing in or out of the utility connection, right? So it's just sort of floating. So in this case, you get a 81R, a rate of change of current, or a rate of change of frequency, because again, the utility grid is locked in to not being able to change phase very quickly, which is translated into frequency. So it's very, very slow, whereas this thing is going to have some shudder to it. And so you'll detect that, and that's how you trip off. So these are things you'll see if you're working on cogen. Synchronization, Dan talked about yesterday, the 25 relay. But overcurrent, that's what we're going to talk about here. And really all I wanted to show is just, this is straight ahead stuff, but sometimes maybe you just don't think about some of these things. This is the typical TCC that you'd see for a medium voltage switchgear lineup. And, you know, so printed out some SKM drawings here. You've got your feeder damage curves, you know, so current, time, and transformer damage curves. And then here is the typical shape of the protective relay. This is holdover from legacy. Back in the 50s, 60s, I guess, there were really two relay manufacturers in the world, General Electric and Westinghouse. And they standardized on, ANSI eventually adopted it, but they standardized on a couple of curves. They called them inverse, very inverse, extremely inverse, definite time. You'll hear those kinds of old terms. And now they're all microprocessor. Those old things used to be induction disk relays. If you've ever seen one, they're like a glass front black case. Open it up and there's like it's the same disk that's inside the watt-hour meter on the side of your house, but it was there for a different purpose. They're all electronic now, but we've emulated the exact same curve. So that's what you'll see. And typically you'll have this right here looks to me like an inverse curve with an instantaneous trip. Very similar, but you'll notice how this curve sort of starts to flare out here. Now this is log paper, right? So what it's showing here is that as you increase the current, you don't proportionally increase the speed as much as you would of, say, a fuse. So here's a medium voltage fuse, same medium voltage switchgear, but this time you've got a fuse upstream. So back there in the lab, you saw the big switch. Well, that can be supplied either with the breaker in the bottom, the vacuum breaker, or you can put fuses in there. If you put fuses, the trip curve looks like this. Now, the danger here, of course, this is where you run into selective coordination concerns. Because what if I had a downstream device, remember I had that 5051, it's going to do something like this number right here. So if you're putting an electronic device downstream of a current limiting fuse, even though it's supposed to trip faster, at the higher currents, it may trip slower than the upstream fuse. And this happens on low voltage fuses also. So you'll see this right away when you plug into your data. Well, how do you fix that problem? Well, there's not much you can do with a fuse, but what you'll see in low voltage world is you'll see something called short time delay. And short time delay puts a little plateau in here. So if you had something that was coming curling around, you know, like this, what you're basically doing is you're saying, under normal circumstances, you're supposed to trip instantaneously. But I'm dialing in a little delay. So above a certain amount of current, below a certain amount of current, you know, I'll still trip that. You know, below this current, I'm going to hit that long time curve, which is actually more of an instantaneous curve. This is an interesting curve now that I look at it. But above a certain current, it's going to hold in. And then at this point, it trips instantaneously. Remember I told you that the 240.87, in the old days, you used to have something that looked like this. There wasn't an instantaneous trip. Now there has to be this instantaneous override in there. We'll talk about that. It's kind of the same problem with low voltage fuses. You have it's terminology. Long time pickup, long time delay, short time pickup, short time delay. Long time pickup moves the curve this way. Long time delay moves it this way. Short time pickup short time pickup is this thing right here, and then short time delay. And then you can also do an I squared T curve on here, which is kind of a recognition that you know, you're really you're hanging in there for maybe 30 cycles, half of a second, at perhaps, well, this isn't that high of a current, but you could have a lot of current, and that's a lot of arc flash. So in this case, what we would do is we would put in an I squared T curve so that the higher currents we would trip. Because again, remember your curve is coming in underneath there, so closer coordination. Instantaneous pickup, know that. Current limiting fuse. Current limiting fuse has a very steep curve. This is, if you were to do the math on this, this is like time is proportional to 1 over I raised to the fifth power. So you always think about, you hear I squared T, you know, which is the energy dissipated in an arc. It's the energy dissipated inside of a resistance. Well, this thing is current limited. It's actually clearing the time that it produces. So if you think about I squared T, if I increase current by 2x, the energy is squared, but the time is cut down by that number to the fifth power. So in a current limiting fuse, the higher the current, the lower the incident energy. That's a little bit counterintuitive, right? You know, you think, oh, well, one of my mitigation technologies would be to put a higher impedance transformer in, bigger wire, longer wire, reduce the current. That's going to reduce my arc flash energy. Well, it would if the clearing time is always the same. And it tends to be that way with breakers. Once you get up to a certain clearing time, they can't go any faster. That's not the case with fuses. So if you have a fuse design, one of the things that you can do to reduce incident energy is increase available fault current. I know, really backwards. But it's because of this. As I increase the current, I decrease the time so dramatically that the product of current times time, time is dropping like a rock. Current's going up by the square, but this is dropping by the fifth. The product of the two is dropping by the third. So you're actually decreasing the energy by a very large amount as you increase fault current. I know, counterintuitive, but that's the issue with low voltage current limiting fuses. Non-current limiting is not the case. Not the case. The difference between a curve like this and a curve like this may not be super evident, but this is sort of falling along the lines. Remember the old that meter voltage relay is, once you get up to the higher currents, it doesn't really, the rate at which it decreases starts to flatten out. And that means that you're going to increase the time dramatically and it doesn't have that situation. But I don't know, the technology with fuses nowadays is so advanced, there's probably not too many examples where you have to buy a non-current limiting anymore. It's just a word of warning there. This one, the only thing I want to say about this is low voltage motor control centers. Nothing special here. You've got, you know, long time pickup, long time delay. And then this isn't short time pickup. This is just uncertainty. You know, it's going to go from, 9, 8, 7, 6, 5. So 50 milliseconds. So 8 cycles. Or, you know, it's kind of not exactly sure how long it's going to clear, but it could clear quicker. But there is also a more common thing that you'll see is low voltage motor control center. Oh, I put the LT, okay, I've already talked about that. With MCPs, motor circuit protector. Just to make you aware of this, because I've actually seen some contractors during commissioning catch these things on fire because they didn't know what they were doing. A motor circuit protector is an instantaneously only clearing device. Well, that's not very useful for protecting wire. So what UL has set up is MCPs always have to be used in conjunction with a time over current device. Well, in MCCs, you've always got an overload relay, because circuit breakers, by and large, don't do a good job of protecting motor, the damage curve in a motor. So you put an overload relay on a motor starter, which is better able to protect, because you can get a class 5, class 10, class 20, and it's better, the curve on that overload relay is better able to protect the motor. Well, you've already got time over current then. I don't care whether the fault is in the motor or the fault's in the wire, that overload relay is going to trip. The issue is that the starter in that bucket is not a fault rated device. It's a load break rated device. So if I have a 600 amp inrush current, that thing can switch it on and off all day long. But if I have a 6,000 amp fault current, it's not rated for that. So what are you going to do? Well, then that's why you put the upstream breaker. But instead of having two time delay curves that you have to coordinate, because then you'd have, you know, if I had a time delay curve in the breaker and a time delay curve in the overload, I want to make sure they didn't miscoordinate, because, you know, it's one thing to go in there and press a reset button, which with electronic relays you can actually do remotely, versus having to go out to the MCC bucket, click off the handle, click back on the handle. So what most people do nowadays is they use an MCP, which has no time current protection. It's just instantaneous. The issues with the contractors are a lot of these, especially in the old days when they were not electronic overloads, they were heater type overloads. We didn't ship the heaters because nobody told us what the full load amps were. In fact, nobody really even knew, because maybe the HVAC system was coming in from, you know, bid it out, and we didn't know which vendor was going to get it. So what they did was they would short out the overload relay, and then they would try to test, you know, they would do a commissioning test. They would put overcurrent on the breaker to verify that it tripped. Well, it's not going to trip. It would just sit there and smoke, catch on fire. There's no time current protection in there. So just make sure you get your contractors, you know, knowledgeable about that little detail. You don't see this with medium voltage motor control centers. Medium voltage motor control centers, do you know the difference between a medium voltage breaker and a medium voltage vacuum contactor? They're vacuum bottles. If you took one and you looked at them, it's like, what's the difference between these two vacuum bottles? There's a big difference. Breaker is a fault clearing device. A motor starter, whether it's medium voltage or low voltage, is a load break device. Well, what's the difference? The difference is that the intensity of that arc. When you have 50,000 amps flowing through something, you have a hotter arc than if you have 5,000 amps flowing. Well, okay, why don't you just put the 50,000 amp rated vacuum bottle in the motor starter? It's not that much more expensive. Maybe it's not any more expensive. Maybe it'd actually be cheaper. Why don't you switch motors on and off with breakers, essentially? Why do you have to have a special design called a medium voltage motor control center? I could just take that medium voltage breaker you guys saw, reprogram the trip unit, because I can guarantee you I can create whatever curve you want. I can copy anything. Why do we have this extra product line called medium voltage control? The issue is, remember that BIL story I told you about yesterday? Motors have very low basic impulse level ratings. When I open up that breaker, I create an arc. I interrupt inductive circuits. When I interrupt inductive circuits, just like I told you about that ground fault problem yesterday, I create a voltage transient. The magnitude of that voltage transient is a function of the magnitude of the current I chop. Well, and chop is a key word. That sine wave is going up and down, up and down. Dan mentioned yesterday that it's easier to break in AC than it is to DC, because when you open it up, it goes through zero. But what happens is, here's what's very interesting. What happens is, it doesn't interrupt right at a current zero. It interrupts a little bit above a current zero. Because what ends up happening is that's a noisy arc. And there's a sine wave, there's a 60 hertz fundamental sine wave, but there's this trashy noise. Well, as soon as one of those noise spikes crosses zero, the arc is extinguished. So I could have 5, 6, 7, 8, 10, 12 amps of current flowing, and then I instantaneously, I mean literally within nanoseconds, I've switched it off. Well, you put nanoseconds in the denominator, even though I only have 2 or 3 in the numerator, and I get megavolts, and that megavolts blows up starters, blows up motors. What you'll see in a motor starter is a very low chop rated contactor. It's think of it soft contacts. The materials are, it's soft. So it can't interrupt fault currents. It would be blown to smithereens. But it has very low chop. And so your motors last longer. That's the difference between. That's the only point. I mean, you won't know that from looking at the TCC curve. The other thing that you'll run into is, since it can't interrupt fault currents, how do you interrupt faults? These things always are fused. Another interesting thing, how do you ensure that it's the fuse that clears the fault, not the contactor that clears the fault? Well, when you get a fault, Dan said this yesterday, bus fault just goes to zero. I mean, you don't put UPSs on these things. And capacitor trip devices are designed to trip in the presence of the fault, not stay closed in the presence of a fault. How do you make this contactor stay closed during a fault? Because you want that upstream fuse to clear. There's really interesting technology, shading coil technologies, magnetic flux linkage and things like that, that keeps this contactor closed, allows that upstream fuse to clear. So it's a surprising amount of technology just to make sure that your big $5,000 horsepower motors don't get burned up, which is not a good thing. So that's the story behind that. Well, that's all I want to say about time current curves. I know that was sort of, fast and strange, eclectic kind of information, but that's the kind of stuff that we get calls about all the time, and they don't teach you this in engineering school, so that's why I wanted to share that. Now let's just talk about real quick, switchboard, switch gear, 891, 1558, 1066, 489, all these. You'll see, it's all your specs, but what's the deal? What's one versus the other? So I'm starting with bolt-on multi-case circuit breakers, panel boards and switchboards, UL891. That's what one of our switchboards looks like. That's kind of what everybody's switchboard looks like. Just a big gray box, a BGB as we call them. In the UL world, it's 600 volts. Why does that say 600 amps there? But anyway, it's 600 volts. We don't see IEC over here. Do you guys do any overseas stuff at all outside? Okay. You know, they have different voltage ratings, you know, 690 volts and that kind of thing. You can still get, you know, even though it's a switchboard, people think, oh, well, maybe you can't get this kind of current ratings. Well, that's true. I mean, we make switch, low voltage switch gear up to 10,000 amp bus, only up to 6,000 amp bus. But frankly, you know, no contractor wants to terminate 6,000 amp. I mean, how many 500s per phase is that? I mean, it's not pretty. Three cycle rating. The key thing I want to tell you about three cycle rating is, what does that tell you with regards to selective coordination? Remember, the definition of selective coordination is the breaker closest to the fault clears. So, how much coordination can I get between two breakers if the maximum amount of delay I'm allowed to put on any breaker that's mounted in this board is only three cycles? I don't care whether I put a power breaker in there. The maximum amount of delay, because the board is only braced and tested for three cycles. So could I use switchboards in any selective coordination system? Not according to UL. Are they shipped on pretty much every job? Yeah. You know? This is one of those AHJ kinds of things that I don't think they've really thought about.
That's a good point, because to Dave's point, you can put power breakers on the primaries, you put power breakers on the feeds. It's kind of a hybrid.
Yeah.
Very 891 label, but the plus cycle is three cycle.
Three cycle. Motor control centers. Three cycles. UL845. Transfer switches, UL1008, three cycles. How many times, I mean, think about it. Think about the code requiring selective coordination on an emergency bus. You're going to put a 1008 transfer switch on that bus. It's not rated for selective coordination. It is a mismatch application because you need to have that generator main stay in and allow the downstream device to clear. That means you're going to need delay. UL1008 is only tested to three cycles. So we've got a lot of weird stuff out there in the world. And a lot of it's legacy. Selective coordination hasn't been a big deal until the last few years. I mean, it's been on elevator circuits forever. But I'm just telling you, you run into stuff like this. People specify switch boards all the time, and then they say selective coordination. Okay. Do you know what you're doing? So, anyway, front or rear access, typically one of the benefits of switchboard design, especially motor case, is that they're almost always front accessible, so I can put them up against a wall and I can get a smaller room. So that's a good thing. At least in the U.S., the design standard is NEMA PP2 and UL891. And then, as we're talking about, you can put power breakers in there. A power breaker is a 1066 rated device. That's a 30 cycle rated device. And there's a dial on the front, and I can dial in 30 cycles all day long. So I could ship that gear to the job site with that breaker in there. It's perfectly acceptable. And somebody could come in and do a study, and somebody, not knowingly, just goes up there and dials in 30 cycles and goes home. Got a selectively coordinated system. Again, you're playing Las Vegas here. What's the likelihood of getting a bolted fault? I mean, close to zero, as you can imagine. About the only time I could ever think of getting a bolted fault is, think of this scenario. You're building a building, and they're pulling multiple conductors per phase. And remember, Dan was saying you never want to put all A's, all B's, and all C's. So you've wrapped the brown, and you've wrapped the orange, and you've wrapped the yellow tape. But at the other end of the line, somebody got brown and yellow mixed up. And so they're connecting all the browns together, and they're connecting all the yellows together, and they're connecting all the oranges together. But unbeknownst to them, they've created a bolted fault between the A and the C phase. Well, now you close in the breaker, bam, you're going to get a bolted fault. But that's during startup. That's not during normal operation. You won't have... you theoretically have trained people in there, but the front end of this thing could let go and just make a real mess. So anyway, just a little tidbit for you. You can also get something called drawout MCCB. If I'm not trying to confuse you, how about if I confuse you even more? Because multi-case circuit breakers, the multi-case circuit breaker always has an instantaneous override. Because you can even put a trip unit inside of a MCCB that has a short time delay, but it's sort of a fake short time. I mean, up to a certain current is short time, but then after that it goes instantaneously because it's not a power breaker. Well, power breakers typically are drawout. Well, now we have a drawout MCCB. You know where we've been seeing this a lot? Data centers. Because downtime is so critical to those folks. They like the idea of drawout, but why pay for the power breaker? Could you do it in a MCCB? And the answer is yes. But don't get tripped up by the fact that it's still a three-cycle device. I mean, we're not talking, when I say short time, I mean, it's really short time. So, but it is drawout. And the short circuit ratings drop a little bit because those stabs, it's the funny thing about those stabs is when you bolt a breaker in, I can get 200,000 amps of interrupting. When I stab a breaker in, I'm being held by springs. And the springs aren't as strong as a bolt, you know, with a lock washer and a torque wrench. So this one's only good for 100,000 amps. But, you know, that might be good enough. Same standards. And I can put the same size breakers in there. Here's another. Okay, you want to talk about another clone? Have you heard of insulated case circuit breakers? Now there's molded case breakers and there's power breakers, but there's something called an insulated case breaker. An insulated case breaker is a power breaker with an instantaneous override. Now, what's this all about? Okay. What if you wanted the features of the power breaker, the stored energy, the remote trip and close, but you weren't building a system that needed to stay closed in a high current fault? So why pay for the robustness of a power breaker? So there's this design called insulated case, but it's an 891 standard also. Higher insulation rating. Notice that the last insulation, the switch boards, were only insulated to 600 volts. This is insulated to 2200 volts. Now we can go up to 10,000 amps as opposed to 6,000 amps. And you'll notice that it says four cycle on the current limiting. This is the insulated case story. It's insulated case. It's not a short, there's no short time rating. You get one more cycle than an MCCB, but it's not a power breaker. So it's, you know, it's not, you can get short time up to four cycles. I'll just leave it at that. Same standard, 891. It's the same switch board standard. It's not a switch gear standard. And, same kind of devices. And then, of course, the big fella is the 1558. Now, that right there is rear accessible, meaning that you have to have it in the middle of the room, but it can be, in the last couple of years, you can now get front accessible switch gear, which is nice. What you do is you put a side panel and then they bring the lugs out the side. Now I can push it up against the wall and make it much easier to install. This is, it doesn't have insulated bus like you would see in medium voltage metal clad gear, but it does have compartmentalized. So each one of those things is inside of its own little bucket tray. Each one of those breakers racks out. The ratings are much beefier. Now this one says current limited up to four cycles. So think about this. What is the definition of current limiting? Current limiting says I am clearing that fault so quickly that I chop off the peak of the current. Well, short delay says if I get a fault, I'm actually staying closed to allow a downstream device to clear. Well, can you have short time and current limiting on the same breaker? No. Pick one. Either you want it to trip very quickly on high currents, or you don't. So that's, you know, that's another one of the things. Don't write in a spec, you know, shall be rated, you know, 150,000 amps current limiting, and, you know, needs to be a 30 cycle delay, because it's kind of like, you know, two opposing standards. Speaking of standards, now we jump into a whole new list of industry standards, the C37 standards, the 1558, and then up in Canada, the CSA C2222. Power breakers, and there you go. Now, the reason I put this slide next is whenever somebody talks about switch gear, we always talk about the reason you're paying for switch gear is so that it can stay closed during a fault. That's pretty much it. Otherwise, just buy multi-case breakers. Trip instantaneously. But then in the 2011 code, this Article 240.87 appeared, and then it was modified in the 2014 code. And it says, it's pretty innocuous. It says, where the highest continuous current rating trip setting for which the actual current device installed in circuit breaker is rated or can be adjusted is 1,200 amps or higher, 247A and B shall apply. Well, what's 247A and B? So anything over 1,200 amps, you have to do something to it. Well, A says, well, you have to document. You have to document that this breaker has been designed, installed, and operated and inspected appropriately. Okay, well, that's pretty... How does that change from anything else that we've been doing? But the coup de grace is the B. The B says you have to have a method to reduce the time, the clearing time. And it can only be one of these five choices. You have, well, and you'll see that the fifth choice is actually a little bit of an optional. You can do different things. But first is you have to include zone selective interlocking in any 1200 amp breaker or larger. Or you have to include differential relaying. Or you have to include an energy reducing maintenance switching with local status indicator, or energy reducing active arc flash mitigation system, maybe like a light sensing system, and then the all other. Well, those are all very different things. They all have very different pros and cons. And what I kind of like to do is talk a little bit about that, because we see, I won't say misapplication, but I see, do you know why you've picked one of those things versus the other and what you're really trying to do? But maybe ask the first question is, it doesn't say in there, hey, if I've got instantaneous trip, I'm good. No, it says any breaker over 1200 amps. By the way, that was one of the changes they made from the 2011 code. The 2011 code said if you don't have instantaneous, then you have to have one of these solutions. The 2014 code said get rid of that. Any breaker over 1200 amps, you have to have one of these solutions. Why isn't instantaneous good enough? Well, let's just, I'm going to go into a little more detail about this energy reducing maintenance switch, but you heard Dan talk about, I think he used the term ARMS switch yesterday. I'll talk a little bit more about what that's all about. But basically it's an active system that is in addition to the trip unit that you already have inside your protective device. You say, Dave, why am I putting all this extra complexity in there? Why do I have to have this arc reducing active maintenance system? Why couldn't I just have instantaneous? I mean, if the issue is that, you know, I get it. If you've got only LS in there, the breaker's going to take 30 cycles a trip, and the guy's going to be, you know, fried for 30 seconds. But what if the guy's working on the equipment? Couldn't you just let me turn on the instantaneous? Isn't that good enough? Well, no. And here's why. Think about the instantaneous trip on a breaker. You know, you've got a nominal phase current that's going along up and down, and maybe you've got some motors, and the motor has an inrush, and of course you don't want the breaker to trip because you had an inrush current. But let's say that I had a ground fault or another low current fault. Have you guys ever heard about ground faults literally burning down switchboards? I mean, got some great videos. you think to yourself, my gosh, look at that fireball coming out of thing. Why isn't the breaker tripping? Well, it's because it's below the pickup of the breaker. I mean, think of a welder. I mean, a welder is a 10,000 amp. It's creating an arc flash. It's a controlled arc flash. It melts everything in its path, but it's relatively low current. Relatively. I mean, it's not 100,000 amps. I can melt metal way less than 100,000 amps. So I can burn down switchgear. So if I get one of those low current arcing faults, you know, it may never trip or may not trip quick enough. So what we really need is we need two instantaneous settings, or we need something more sensitive is what the issue is. Well, thing number one, well, you know, if you think about it, it's not going to trip there. And so instantaneous really isn't good enough. But remember the first thing on that list, actually the first thing on the list, I think it was ZSI. But let's talk about bus differential, because I'll put bus differential in the category of, in low voltage systems, probably the least likely that you would use, only because of the cost. In medium voltage systems, I would move that into the most likely that you would use. So let's talk about bus differential, just to make sure everybody is familiar with what we're talking about. It's called 87, and you'll see 87B for bus differential. You'll see 87T for transformer differential, 87G for generator differential. And you typically only see it on medium and high voltage systems because of the cost and complexity, which I'll show you here. But in the simple case, I'm showing low voltage breakers. In the simple case, what is differential, bus differential? Well, I got three breakers, three feeder breakers in the main. So, you know, we've got current coming out of the main, and it equals the current in the feeder. So if I took current in phase, or feeder one, plus feeder two, plus feeder three, that has to equal the current in the main. I mean, it's Kirchhoff's law again. We're talking about that. But what if I got a fault on my switchgear bus between the main and the feeder? Well, you know, I would have a protective device that would be measuring. It wouldn't measure it. I mean, this device measures the current coming out of the main, the current coming out of each of the feeders, and then it just simply does the mathematics to sum them all together. If I have that fault, it kind of looks like a fourth feeder. Well, now the main current is equal to the sum of the three feeders plus this fourth feeder, so no longer is the main current equal to the sum of the three feeders. Well, that 87B relay does the math and says, bam, instantaneous trip. There's no reason to have any delay whatsoever, because the sum of those three currents always has to be the same if there's ever a mismatch. Now, you say, well, that doesn't sound very complicated. Why don't we use this? Isn't the devil always in the details? So, what are we actually doing there? We're measuring current, and it has to be very precise. Have you ever run into situations? Has anybody ever worked on a bus differential system? Be very afraid. This one right here is usually okay because it's going to be shipped inside of the gear by the vendor. But here's one that's going to kill you. And this is, it's like, I'm telling the contractor, they don't believe me. Generator differential. What do you do with generator differential? Or cable differential even. Typically what you'll do is you'll put the differential CT on the output of the breaker, and then there's a cable run, and then there's a generator down here, and you put another set of CTs on that generator. And so what you're doing is you're basically protecting this zone down here. Well, this is being shipped by vendor A. This might be shipped by vendor B. Who's coordinating what kind of CTs you're buying? Because let me tell you, a 405 CT is not a 405 CT, even if it has the same burden, even if it has the same accuracy class, maybe even the same vendor. I mean, for this to work, I have to have extremely balanced CTs. So if I get dogs and cats coming in on my job site, and I feed that into the 87B, it may not show up under nominal test currents, because it may only show up when the CT gets high current, because CTs will, what's called, saturate. In other words, the linearity, the current coming in versus the current coming out, the curve will start to deviate as you get higher and higher current, because they're not perfectly linear. They're not real accurate close to 0 amps, and they're not real accurate at really high current. In fact, ANSI standard says that anything over about 40 amps on the secondary is, you're off, you know, off bet. Well, what is 40 amps? That's 8 times nominal current. Well, holy cow, I can get a fault that's 15 times, right? So that tells me that, by definition, all of these CTs are going to be nonlinear at fault current, but they're going to be nonlinear at different levels. Well, I might have a motor inrush, or I might have a, you know, anyway, I'm talking a lot. The issue is, if you're going to do a bus differential, make sure that you have somebody take systems responsibility for making the end-to-end differential system work. Otherwise, you will have problems. And it's mostly CT issues. CT balancing, CT accuracy and linearity, and CT burden. We don't have time to go into it. I'm gonna send everybody, I guess everybody has given us emails, so I can send you the copies of my slides. In the appendix of this presentation, I go into more detail about how do you calculate CT burden and CT linearity. But that's the big issue. So on low voltage systems, don't do it. Here's what I recommend on low voltage systems. ZSI, zone selective interlocking. I call this poor man's bus differential. It sort of does the same thing, except it's using the internal CTs of the breaker. Because after all, you saw the ZSI, or the bus differential, you had to bolt on a separate zero sequence CT, a bus differential CT. These guys already have CTs inside of them. So what ZSI is doing is it's basically doing the same thing, except it's using communications between the breakers. And the way it works is the breakers talk to each other, and they say, did you see the fault? Did you see the fault? Who sees the fault? And based on that knowledge, they can figure out who needs a trip and who can kind of hold in there. So let's go through the scenario we just talked about. Let's say I had a fault on my feeder, and no longer is the current in M1 equal to 1, 2, and 3. But here's another thing I want to ask you a question. I have 35,000 amps of fault current. I have a half of a second of delay on that main breaker. If all else being equal, that breaker's going to stay closed for a half of a second. So the amount of fault current that's going to come out of that thing is above a category 4 in this example. So what could I do differently? What could I do to make that thing go clearer? Well, let me ask you a question. That fault right there, does F1 or F2 or F3 see that fault current? Which breaker in that system sees the fault current? M1, the main breaker, is the only one. Well, only one. There's no fault current flowing through F1, F2, or F3. So M1 basically radios to its downstream breakers. Because remember what we're doing here. I'm going to keep the half second delay in there if one of my downstream breakers sees the fault, because the downstream breaker is the one that's going to clear the fault. I'm not going to clear the fault. I have to stay closed. But if none of the downstream breakers see the fault, why do I delay? There's nobody downstream that's going to clear the fault. So in a zone selective interlock system, the main breaker is talking to its feeders, saying, hey, I just saw 35,000 amps. Do you see it? Do you see it? Do you see it? They're going, what are you talking about? Well, if there's nothing coming back, M1 goes out instantaneously. It says, forget this half second stuff. I'm going now. Because nobody downstream saw the fault. So it's a great system. And you don't have to buy extra CTs, and you don't have to worry about balancing and all that other stuff that you got to deal with bus differential. Now, why doesn't everybody use this? It's not as sensitive. There's a communications going on there. So whereas the other system, is greasy fast, this one's a little bit slower. So this one, it's pretty good. I mean, it drops you down. In this case, the example was it went from a half of a second down to 80 milliseconds. So it dropped from 43 calories down to 7 calories. You didn't have to wear the moon suit now. So if you have a ZSI system, and remember, it's automatic. It's not like you have to go up and and flip an arm switch or anything like that. You literally, when you're in the, if you're in the room, if you're working on the gear, and for, you know, obviously we never want to work on gear live, but you know, if you're in oil and gas or maybe data centers, you know, uptime is an issue. There's nothing to set. It's all automatic. It just runs. And it will automatically detect a bus fault between two breakers with a ZSI system. Well, then why don't we just leave it at that? You know, it sounds like it's a great plan. Well, it's still 7 calories. And 7 calories is still a lot of energy. So that's why we introduced this thing called the arc reduction maintenance system. Every one of those letters means something. Maintenance is key. This is a manually operated system. You physically walk up to the gear and you say, I am taking responsibility to work on this gear live. I'm going to do lockout tagout procedures. I'm going to flip this thing into high speed mode. And I want to have the absolute lowest possible energy come out of this system. But here's the other thing. Remember I told you this thing came out in 2011? You'll run into, there's some situations where you'll run into, and arc reduction maintenance systems are being sold that aren't really anything more than dressed up ZSI. Now ZSI is not bad. ZSI is not bad. But I'm going to show you the difference between ZSI and this in a quick second. In other words, think about this. Remember that previous slide I showed you with the main and the feeders, and the main was a half of a second, and the feeders didn't see the fault, and it said, nobody sees the fault, I'm going to go instantaneously. Well, one of the ways you can make that main breaker always go instantaneously is disconnect the communications to it. Have a little switch that just turns off the communications, so if a fault occurs, it's never going to hear anybody say, I see the fault, so it will always trip instantaneously. So you'll see some vendors will actually, that's their arc reduction system. You walk up. But why? You've already got ZSI. It's automatic. Why? It doesn't do anything extra. You're just, and in fact, if you forgot to turn it off, now you no longer have your selectively coordinated system. So here's what you'll see. Some ZSI systems, so that's kind of a diagram of what's going on inside of your circuit breaker. You have, here's your current path, there's your contact, there's CT, feeds that into an analog to digital converter. You've got a microprocessor that reads the current, compares it to a set point, and then if it's above a set point, it closes an electronic switch, fires a solenoid, trips the breaker. That's basically what a circuit breaker or electronic trip unit does. So what some people will do is they'll say, oh, well, I'll send a digital input into the microprocessor to say, no intentional delay. You know, current gets above a certain value, go instantaneously. It'd be sort of like sliding that instantaneous TCC curve way down to the left. Great. Well, the issue is you don't get any speed improvement. It's depends on the breaker. It's 40 to 80 milliseconds. It is what it is. It's ZSI. But there is a better way, or at least a faster way. And we call it faster than instantaneous, which is kind of funny. If you talk to a person who's not in the industry, How can you have anything that's faster than, what is it, time traveler? But we know in our world, when we say instantaneous, we mean the instantaneous trip, which has delay. So if I can make something faster than the instantaneous trip in a breaker, that's what I'm saying here. So how could I do that? Well, the way I could do that is I still have the same trip unit, but what if I bypassed the trip unit? Because think about it. There's a certain amount of time for that A to D converter to quantify and it's basically a little computer here that's converting current. It has to calculate RMS values. It has to do, you know, smoothing and anti-aliasing and all the stuff that those things do. And this microprocessor, we'll Well, think about it. It's a little circuit breaker. Do you think it has a big, eight core Pentium, processor running at 3 gigahertz? No. The processor in there is probably running at a few megahertz. And, so it takes a few milliseconds to make up its mind to do something. So there's just this intentional delay just because of this loop right here. Well, what if we just put in an auxiliary circuit? What if we tapped off of the CT and we took the energy from the CT and rammed it directly into the trip coil, bypassed all the electronics, bypassed all the A to D conversion, and all we did in there was we put some voltage dividers so that we could manage how much trip current actually caused the breaker to trip, and we put in a Zener diode so that it didn't nuisance trip. Well, now the current comes in, goes around here. There's no energy storage in here. There's, electricity moves at about 66% of the speed of light, so it's getting around that horn pretty fast. And trips this thing. Well, the bottom line is, it still takes a while for that magnet to move, but we're down to about 17 to 40 milliseconds, or about half. Well, half the clearing time is directly correlates to half of the energy released. So if I have, remember that previous example with the ZSI where we went from 4 down to a 2? I can maybe go down to a 0 now. And that's the big deal of this arms switch, is that I can go so fast that the thing just pops. And so here we've got this lower arms trip, it trips. But I think the big key thing is we've got to, I don't have it on the speakers here, but okay, so you saw the arc there. This is with arms turned on. It's like a little firecracker instead of a fireball. When they do the calculation, this one wasn't that high because we only had 9,000 amps available on the thing, but we went down to 0. So that means that you could be sitting right on top of it, dressed like me, and a 1,200 amp breaker, and you wouldn't get burned. It goes that fast. So here's an interesting example. Normally, this is very interesting. It's very difficult for us to get testimonials from people because it's kind of embarrassing when you have accidents on your site. So people don't want to talk about this kind of stuff. But this guy actually wrote a paper and presented it at the IEEE Electrical Safety Workshop. And it was a classic example. He had it was energized work permit, 21,000 amps. And what they had to do is they had to move some cables from one compartment to another. And these were big cables. And so what they did was they attached rope, non-conductive rope, because they're inside of switch gear. And then they were pulling it, but they needed to put a come-along on there, the thing that kind of pulls the cables in. But the come-along had a chain. And the chain, as they coming along, is dropping lower and lower and lower, and it got across energized bus. And it, boom, as you can imagine. Now we're talking about a system, 480 volts, 21,000 amps of available fault current. But this was energized work gear, work permit, and they had arms activated. So remember, the idea with arms is that I'm in the gear. I don't want to work on energized, but because I have to work on energized, I'm going to switch on this high speed, 66% of the speed of light kind of a thing. And it tripped. And the miracle of this, let me tell you this. If you've ever seen a chain dropping across 480 volt bus, normally you're going out and buying a new bus. Normally you're buying new electrical gear, and sometimes the guy's in the hospital, and sometimes worse. That's the normal situation. 480 volts is nothing to mess around with. He wrote this paper, and he was so impressed with it, because that's all that happened. it dropped in there, and there's like a little ding mark right here. But if you think about it, that thing tripped so fast that it interrupted the fault, that it didn't even bubble the paint. They went in there and they basically cleaned it up, and they had the system back online in like 4 hours. It shut the plant down, shut the entire plant down. But they had the thing cleaned up and they were back online. They didn't have to buy new equipment in emergency. We get plenty of emergency orders. You know, we have these things, they call them, well, they used to call them satellites and service centers. What do they call them now? Customer...
CSMCs.
I
call them satellites.
They're like mini factories. We have mini factories all over the country one of their purposes in life is to build equipment in emergencies. I mean, what will happen is literally we'll get a call at 5 o'clock on a Friday night, you know, some 4,000 amp switchboard blew up at some place, and a new one, which, I mean, 4,000 amp switchboard, I mean, Tim, how long does it take to normally get a 4,000 amp switchboard built, you know, out of the factory? Yeah, so it's months and months and months. But we'll ship it Sunday morning. Well, they didn't have to do that here. So this thing, it was kind of amazing. That's the arms. And again, but it's that kind of arms. It's not the bypass ZSI. You're not going to get that performance. This is a different kind of an animal. And here's another example of where you've run into it. This was a paper company. I think it was Weyerhaeuser, actually. the National Electric Code allows you, by code, to not necessarily need a main breaker on a switchboard if you have no more than 6 feeder breakers. Because the idea is, I guess I can turn off 6 loads within a short period of time. I don't need a main breaker. So I can save money. Because those main breakers, I mean, think about it. If you have, you're at a paper mill and you've got 600 amp breakers, that's 4,000, 5,000, 6,000 amp main breaker. That's saving a lot of money. But the issue is, if you think about it, it'll be a system that looks exactly like what you saw back there in the back. You have a medium voltage switch with a fuse, because, they're less expensive than power breakers. And how many times is the transformer going to fault? I mean, you're kind of rolling the dice. You're doing some value engineering. And then you've got your low voltage switchgear, 1558 switchgear. But there's no main in there. So if you look at the one line, if I got a fault on... the bus, what's going to clear the fault? Those fuses. Well, those fuses have to be upsized to deal with the inrush of that transformer. So 105 calories. You can't even put 100. Have you ever seen those, I don't know if you guys ever watched hockey, but you know, every once in a while they'll have the people go out and they have these, they call them fat suits. They're like these big Michelin man kind of things, and they're just sort of going around like this. That's what a 100 calorie suit looks like. It looks like a Michelin man. It doesn't even work. You can't even use that. Well, wait a minute. This is a continuous process plant. They can't ever work on the gear. They can't rack out any of those breakers. So this is a problem, right? Well, here's where ARMS comes to the rescue. It's a kind of an interesting example of ARMS technology. What if I took out the fuse, because remember that switch can fit one of those little miniature, they're not miniature, but it's a medium voltage breaker that's the same size as a low voltage breaker. Because low voltage breakers, we open the arc in air. In the medium voltage, we put it inside of a vacuum bottle and we can make it smaller. So what if we did that? What if we put in a little breaker, and of course the little breaker has a trip unit, but this design isn't any better than the fuse. I mean, I still have to size this in trip settings to deal with the inrush, so it's still going to be 100 calories, so this isn't getting me anything. ARMS is the key. ARMS says, remember that signal, that CT that came in and goes right to the trip coil? where do I have flexibility on where I put that CT. I mean, I could put the arm CT right here. I could use that CT right there. But you know what? What if I put the CT right there? Let's think about that. What if I put a CT right there and brought that into the arm circuit? Let's say that all of these breakers were open. There's no load on the secondary. And let's say this switch is open, or the breaker's open. And I close in, I energize this transformer. Will that CT see the inrush current? Mm-hmm. If I put a CT right there, will it see the inrush current? No. Ooh. If I don't see the inrush current, I can set my trip settings way down. Way down. And so that's what we did. We put the second, you consider generically an IEEE 5051 device, but it's the arm circuit. We put the CT right there. When we did that, if I get a fault here, I mean, both of them will see it. But this guy can trip way faster and doesn't have to deal with that artificial upsizing because of the transformer inrush. When I do the math, it drops it down to 4 calories. Went from 100 calories to 4 calories. I mean, that's like off the charts. Well, now they don't even need the moon suit. I mean, before you couldn't even buy the Michelin suit. They don't even need a moon suit now. They can go up there with flame retardant clothing. This is what it looks like. That's what the fuse switch looks like when you take the switch, the fuse is out. You keep the switch, which is in the top, and you put that little vacuum. That's a 15 kV breaker. It's kind of amazing that you can get one that small. You put it in there. Now the question is, that's the other thing, one of the reasons why it's small. Think about this. I don't know if you're familiar with medium voltage switchgear that much, but medium voltage breakers typically always require protective relays. You have to buy this protective relay, you know, but circuit breakers typically have the trip unit built into the product. Well, this product has a trip, it's a medium voltage breaker, but it has a trip unit in it. So it not only is it smaller in the physical size, but you don't have to have the control cabinet like you would normally have. Remember the medium voltage switchgear back there? You had a breaker in the lower section, and then you had the upper section with the trip units and all that. Well, but I have a problem here. I need two of those. There's only room for one. Where am I going to put the second one, right? Because I had one that has to protect the primary of the transformer, because it's still got, you know, if the transformer faults, I still have to trip it. But then I got this arm circuit, so where am I putting the second trip unit? Well, what these guys did, I guess it's kind of good. They just bolted a box, a Hoffman box on the front of the unit. Well, I can't say that anymore. But Cooper makes enclosures. But a Cooper enclosure bolted on the front of that, but that's all it is. So you put the, call it the second protective relay inside of there, and
Does that maintain a UL listing by doing that out in the field like that? Or?
Yeah, this was actually done by us. We were just joking. There's this guy who's retiring, who's like this super genius guy who invented this concept, and that's what they do. Is they run it past the inspectors, and they you can do a field label, or you can obviously buy the thing new and that's on the factory. But
the one you saw yesterday was like that, but done in the factory.
Yeah, it looks a little cleaner because that was just done.
I'm surprised they didn't let you do that on the field and maintain it. UL wasn't.
Well, I mean, UL's familiar with this breaker, mm-hmm. and they're familiar with this lineup. They're familiar with that lineup, and they were building these things in the factory, so they sort of know, they've gone through all those testing, and so I don't know what tests they do in the field. I imagine they do probably bring out some high pot kind of test equipment, but that's a pretty interesting design. I will say one other thing. I mentioned that you had Remember the 240.87, you had five solutions. You had the ZSI, which we talked about. We had bus differential, we talked about. ARMS, we talked about. And then other active sensing. Well, one of the other active sensing technologies is popular is light sensing. Because what light sensing does is you put a light sensor inside the switchgear, and then you feed that back into the protective relay. And if there's a flash, and it's kind of coordinated with the current, so if you're going around with a taking pictures of it, the switchgear doesn't trip offline, you know, it says, well, wait a minute. I don't have need to have any intentional delay because there's this explosion, impending explosion inside the gear. So that's another technology. It's kind of like Dan runs into all these people with the hoax energy savers. Be careful with the hoax light relay folks too. Because remember, the breaker still has to trip. The breaker is the thing that's interrupting the fault. The light sensor could trip in a nanosecond, but it's still going to take many cycles for that breaker to open. So when you actually do the math, you get some savings, but it's not like we've actually seen some vendors be so bold to say, oh, well, if you put these light sensors inside of your equipment, you don't need arc-resistant switchgear anymore. Why not? Because it's going to clear that thing so fast that there'll never be it'll never pressure up and it'll never blow the doors off, and think of all that you'll save. The problem is, what blows up switchgear is the pressure wave. Peak pressure is achieved in a quarter of a cycle. The energy is proportional to the time, I squared T. So the longer it burns, yeah, you will reduce the heat energy, but the pressure, you have maximum pressure in a quarter cycle. So unless you're offline in 4 milliseconds, or less, 4 milliseconds, it's like no net gain, you know, because a quarter of a cycle is 4.166 milliseconds. So don't, it just reminds me of that contractor, oh yeah, you should just install this, you know. So just be careful. I mean, they do help, but be careful on how oversold the benefits of it are. It's another good thing in your toolbox, just don't go crazy with it.